petunia. Life is no thrill, it's worse than ill. So draw the right conclusion, let there be still.
Welcome to episode number 81 of the Exploring Antinatalism podcast, a podcast showcasing the wide range of perspectives and ideas throughout antinatalism as it exists today, through interviews with antinatalists and non-antinatalist thinkers and creators of all kinds, now running 4 years strong. I'm your host, Amanda Sukenik, and today I'm speaking with legendary founder of the Free Software Foundation, developer of the GNU Project, winner of the MacArthur Fellowship Genius Grant, and author of the 2012 article, Why It Is Important to Have Few or No Children, Dr. Richard Stallman. Before we begin today's episode, hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to episode number 81 of the Exploring Antinatalism podcast, featuring, of course, my conversation with Dr. Richard Stallman. Before we begin, Mr. Stallman and myself would like to make it clear, though this episode will be made available everywhere, we would prefer that today's show be viewed and listened to off of conventional platforms such as YouTube, iTunes, and the like, and instead watch and listen to on the Exploring Antinatalism podcast website. Link below to where you can find this episode and where it can best be enjoyed. Anything you'd like to add to that?
Yes, I would. Okay. Just that GNU is pronounced GNU.
GNU. Okay, my apologies.
Yes. We don't read it as an initialism, because it's more fun to call it GNU.
It is.
But the other thing is, what I launched the development of is the GNU operating system. And this is an important thing about it. GNU is an operating system. It's something you can install on your computer so that you don't run Windows, you don't run Mac OS, you don't run Chrome OS, because those are non-free programs. And they put the user under the power of the owner of that software. Whereas GNU is free software that respects users' freedom. The users have control over it, both individually and collectively, and that's why it isn't unjust. So if you want to learn more about this free software philosophy and why our freedom calls for us to reject freedom-denying software, user-subjugating software, look at FSF, that's Foxtrot Sierra Foxtrot, .org/TEDx, which is a 14-minute video where I present these ideas for non-technical people, and you'll get a basic idea of what it is I mainly stand for, and you can learn more about that if you want. And in GNU.org, you can find a lot more about free software, as well as the GNU operating system itself. Of course, developing something big like that is a project, and we call that the GNU Project. It's developing the GNU operating system. So having got that out of the way, we can get to our topic for today. But I should explain, that free software philosophy is the reason why I hope nobody will watch this using iTunes. iTunes is non-free software, and it's designed to control, restrict, and snoop on people. And for your freedom's sake, you shouldn't be using that. I can't tell people what to do, but it's my hope that people will learn something about the injustice that they're being subject to every day if they use the usual non-free software that most people use. And that's why we are recording this through Big Blue Button, which is free software, and I insisted on that. I have never used Zoom. It's a non-free program. I won't have it on my computer. I absolutely refuse. And I do this, first of all, because I won't give up my freedom for some momentary convenience of getting some job done that I want to do, because freedom's important. And I treat it as important by saying, no, I won't use Zoom or Skype or Microsoft Teams or Google Meet or whatever non-free program it might be. I've never used them. I haven't had a non-free program on my computer for many, many years. Once I found it was possible to refuse. And since then, I refuse.
Well, excellent. Makes perfect sense to me. First of all, Richard, thank you for the correction. It shall be GNU forevermore on the Exploring Antinatalism podcast. If I can, I'd like to put a link to the video that you mentioned in the description.
By all means.
Hopefully people will be able to find
means.
That there. Excellent. And thank you, by the way, for welcoming me onto Big Blue Button. It is a pleasure to use software that is that supports freedom, unlike other platforms that I've used in the past. So let me just first start out by saying, welcome to the Exploring Antinatalism podcast. It is a pleasure to have you on the show today. Richard, ages ago, the Wikipedia page for antinatalism featured a section, I believe, called Famous Antinatalists. And as far as I know, that's since been removed for whatever reason from the Wikipedia page. But within that now deleted section, your name was included. And that's how I personally came to learn about you and your work on the subject. In September of 2012, you published a page on your website called Why It Is Important Not to Have Children. That was the original title. And I'm so looking forward to talking all about that article with you in a moment. Before we dive into that, though, I was wondering if we could just start out by you telling us a little bit about yourself. Who is Dr. Richard Stallman?
Well, first of all, my family was sort of painful for me to live in when I was young. It was a lot of anger, a lot of fighting. I was really glad when I escaped by moving away to go to college. To me, it was escaping. I used to sometimes say to myself, I want to go home, meaning the non-existent place that I'd probably never find. This would be when my mother was angry at me. Now, I have to say that after I moved away, she worked very hard on changing, and she changed a lot, and she led me in starting to work on myself and our relationship. And ultimately, we did express love for each other. I could give her a hug and mean it. I would go sometimes to visit her because I was looking forward to seeing her again. Now, we would still fight some after a few days had gone by, but I was glad to see her anyway. So things got better. And it's mostly to her credit that they did. And she refutes the belief, oh, my parents are too old to change. Even people as old as I am now and older can change for the better. They can learn. And I think I am learning these days, too. Although no longer with my mother, she died a few years ago.
I'm sorry.
It's sort of sad. There was something I could have done with her that I think I would have enjoyed tremendously, and I didn't think of it until this year, which is that when I went to her apartment, I saw lots of books there that were interesting. And if I had picked one up and read it and talked with her about that book, I would probably have found that conversation extremely interesting, and it would have brought us closer together. And it's not something that occurred to me back then. Sad.
Thank you for that extremely candid answer, Richard. I mean, I'm so glad that you were able to you know, reconcile with her and have a good relationship in the end. Although I'm sorry for what you went through as a child.
Yeah.
And I appreciate you sharing that with us for sure.
Well, but that's very pertinent because I was, I'm not all that good at social relations. It takes a long time, a lot of trial and error for me to learn to be good at any kind of social relationship. And I was sure that if I were a parent, my family would be horrible for the children. Why assume?
I mean,
right?
I didn't mean to interrupt you. Forgive me.
The point is, that's especially nowadays, although, you know, back then, back in the 60s, families in the U.S. weren't as horribly stressful as they are now.
Yeah.
But even then, it was often difficult. And I expected that given something so difficult that lots of people mess up, I was sure to mess it up.
Well, no, quality of family life, I think, is a paramount, you know, piece of importance, you know, for deciding whether to have a child or not. And it's something that a lot of people don't really give much credence to before they make that decision. So, that is certainly a very important reason to, you know, to consider when thinking about the idea of procreating. Well, Richard, your list of accomplishments is really quite extraordinary, though I know this isn't, you know, the subject of our chat today. I was wondering if you wouldn't mind telling our audience a little bit more about the GNU project and the free software movement, which is, you know, really fascinating areas of your work.
I could, but I really recommend people watch that 14-minute video because I practiced saying that talk several times before I actually gave it. And as a result, I got it pretty smooth with few false starts. And if I do it now, of course, I'll get the same ideas across, but I won't do it quite as nicely as I did it there. The basic idea I already said, which is that with free software, the users have the freedom to run it however they wish, to study the source code and change it so the program does what the users want it to do, and they can change the program individually, separately, or they can get together in groups and work together to change the program. In addition, they're not kept divided and, you know, non-free software typically practices divide and rule. You're not allowed to share it with other people. It's forbidden to help your fellow human beings, your fellow citizens, to cooperate with them. And that is an injustice in itself. But with free software, you've got the freedom to make exact copies and then give or sell those copies to others. And you also have, that's freedom number two. And freedom three is the freedom to make copies of your modified versions and give or sell them to others when you wish. And so the four freedoms, zero, to run the program as you wish, one, to study and change the source, two, to redistribute exact copies, and three, to redistribute modified versions. Those four freedoms give users the control over that software. And that's what makes free software just. Whereas a non-free program is non-free because it doesn't respect the user's freedoms, it doesn't give users control, and as a result, it's unjust.
Thank you so much for going through that. And like I said, the link to that video will be in the description. So I'll definitely direct people there. Thank you so much, Richard. Richard, may I ask, why are you or are you not an antinatalist?
Well, I'm pretty much an antinatalist because I urge people for the most part not to have children. And, of course, for me, this started with realizing that having children would be hell for me and for those children. And I didn't want to mess up my life. And I didn't want to mess up other people's lives. And I have no particular yearning to have children, no special wish to be raising children. And since then, well, in the U.S., I saw that most families were full of pain. I was actually very surprised in Europe to see some happy families. I was almost stunned to meet a family in which people were happy. The parents and the children were generally happy together. And I thought, is this real? I think in Europe, basically, there is somewhat more socialism. Or at least there was back then, like in the 80s and 90s. It's being crushed out now by the usual neoliberalism, make a life a struggle for everybody. And of course, you make life a struggle for people. And it's going to be full of pain and anger. They're going to take it out on each other. And it's so sad. Why would you want that?
Yeah.
So, but that did show me that it is possible to have a happy family in some kinds of environments, which I couldn't have had here. But that doesn't mean everybody can do it. And of course, I'm probably the world's worst parent, or would be if I allow that to manifest itself in its unfortunate way. So then, of course, I found out about that climate disaster was something that wasn't very far away. In fact, I might even live to see it at my age, but people who are young today are surely going to see it. It may kill them, even in a country like the U.S., and surely in other parts of the world where it's a struggle already. I read early in 2023 there was a danger that 200 million people would starve. I haven't read that occurred. Maybe that was averted, but it was a possibility that people involved in humanitarian aid were raising as a concern. Well, 200 million people is more than normally die in the typical year. That would have meant a significant decrease in the Earth's population, brought about the horrible way. And that's what happens if you keep having too many children. The population goes down through horrible suffering. And that's what we should try to avoid.
Yeah.
By not having children, we can keep away from the point at which those disasters will cause so much suffering. And we've got to do that.
I 100% agree. Yeah, thank you for that, Richard. In 2012, your article, originally titled Why It Is Important Not to Have Children, you know, came at a really interesting time, as 2012 really was when I would say things around antinatalism started to kind of coalesce. This was right around the time of the emergence of the first antinatalist online communities. It was around that same time that the first like major academic journal of, you know, featuring criticism of antinatalism was first released. It was an exciting time for the subject that your article kind of emerged in. And so I was just, you know, curious, you know, were you aware of some of these developments around antinatalism at the time? And regardless, what inspired you?
Nothing. I was not aware of them at all.
Okay.
I didn't know that anyone was paying particular attention to my article. I just posted it because it's something I wanted to say. But I did, you know, I added to it from time to time.
Yeah.
And it was many years ago that I added the part which said that I don't wish that no one would have any children. I don't wish for the human species to disappear. I think it's a good thing that there are life forms capable of consciously thinking about the world and reasoning to some extent and having feelings about the world, having feelings about the happiness and unhappiness of others. Humans can do a lot of nastiness and harm and foolishness, but we are also capable of thinking about good and doing good, and we're capable of appreciating and remembering. And I don't wish that that would stop. Years before, I had a friend of mine supported the voluntary human extinction movement, which I didn't agree with back then either.
Mm-hmm.
When I wrote that title, when I said why you shouldn't have children, I didn't mean nobody should have children, but probably you shouldn't have children because you're probably going to mess it up just as I would. I do have somewhat more awareness of my shortcomings than many people have of their own. And so a lot of people are over-optimistic about how well they will do in any particular difficult challenge, whereas I am somewhat more reasonable. I figure if most people mess something up, I probably will too.
Yeah, I definitely want to ask you about that in just a second. I mean,
want to continue addressing what you've already
said.
I'm like this. My response to a complicated subject may be long because it's complicated.
Right.
And there's a lot that's worth saying, I think. So I came across this voluntary human extinction movement and I thought, I don't agree. I'm not going to endorse that. Although I personally am not going to procreate, I don't want to. It was not in direct response to that, but it was just showing what I felt about this issue and things I had thought about for a long time. And then, so a few years after I initially wrote it, I added the part that explains, I don't wish humanity would disappear. But we do need to reduce the human population a lot in a humane way to avoid horrible suffering that's just on the horizon. And now perhaps closer than the horizon.
I mean, this is a bit of a what you're speaking to speaks to a bit of a phenomenon in antinatalism where some antinatalists are extinctionists and some are not. What do you think about that? Like, what do you think about especially as antinatalism, as it's growing and becoming more of an emergent social movement in the world, antinatalist activism is starting to occur in the form of, street activism, different things like that. So, how do you feel about the fact that some antinatalists are, in fact, extinctionists?
I disagree with them, but what more is there to say? I've already stated what I think about that just now.
Perfectly fair.
I can't imagine why I would want squirrels to exist, but not want humans to exist.
Right. Well, that's
anything against squirrels. It's just a random example. I mean, they're a kind of animal life that we see fairly often around here. I'm nothing for or against them, but why have something particularly against humans? I think humans are capable, if we get our act together, of living in a way that doesn't overwhelm and destroy the ecosystems of the earth.
Well, interestingly, you know, some antinatal, just as some antinatalists are extinctionists and some are not, some antinatalists are anthropocentrically minded and some are sentiocentrically minded. So some antinatalists, you know, oppose human reproduction, but other antinatalists extend that to animal reproduction as well. So some antinatalists extend their antinatalism into principles about not breeding animals, you know, either for and you speak a little bit about this in the article about, you know, breeding pets or and many antinatalists are vegans. Some would even, you know, recommend that there be interventions into wild animal suffering. Some even would say that what we should prevent the existence of sentient machines if that were to become a possibility. So anything that has sentience and, you know, is an issue, is the biggest problem in the universe, not because of any sense of hatred, but because of the existence of suffering. The potential for suffering is what needs to be prevented, no matter what material that being were to be made out of.
Well, I think that's a philosophical error. Yes, okay. There is pain. There is also happiness. And sentience, well, I don't know if I would extend the term sentience to non-human animals for the most part. Some have a certain amount. But certainly there's no other species that has the ability to think, remember, and reason as humans do. And I think that that is a good thing. I think that civilization is a good thing. Being able to write things down and keep them and see them later is a good thing. Being able to observe and record what we see and draw conclusions about them and understand how the universe functions and how it got to be here, that's a good thing. And I think it's perverse to wish for that to be ended, to wish for all ability to feel pain or satisfaction of any kind. That's perverse. Now, I read a book whose author I can't remember, but you probably know about it. I wrote on Stallman.org, I posted a refutation of its argument. Do you remember the name and author of that book, Better Never to Be Have Been Born?
Better Never to Have Been by David Benatar.
Yes, I found a fallacy in the argument. And
okay, yes,
you can find that article in stallman.org/articles/, and I don't remember the title right now. I'd have to go look it up, but you could stick it in a subtitle here and a link. In any case, the fallacy was just an arbitrary assumption that non-existent possible humans count as real suffering because for their hypothetical possible suffering. But if you start counting all the possible humans that might have existed, then you end up with infinities on both sides. So it's a fallacy to do that. Either you count real humans, real happiness and suffering, or you count potential happiness and suffering, including potential non-humans that never existed, and you end up with infinity minus infinity, which could be anything. You can't draw any conclusions from that.
Well, I don't actually believe that was Dr. Benatar's intention, was to speak about counterfactuals,
that's what the words mean. That's what the argument really says. If you dismiss the counterfactuals, because the counterfactuals are counted for pain but not counted for pleasure or any other good thing, and that's what makes it a fallacy. But if you did count them on both sides, you couldn't reach a conclusion either. The only thing that enables him to reach a conclusion is that he counts the infinity on one side and not on the other. And so it's pretty clear which one outweighs which. But if you do it validly, then you just can't get a conclusion. And so I reject that conclusion, and therefore it doesn't convince me to be an extinctionist. Sorry.
It's okay. Well, I think, you know, I think the point of the Benatarian axiological asymmetry is to say that, you know, we do not have a duty to create good lives, but we have all the duty in the world not to create bad ones. And so it's basically just an argument from the fail safe that by not creating lives,
I don't agree with those premises.
Risks.
You see,
yeah, I understand.
And it's still, why do you assume that all the lives are bad? That's a consequence of the asymmetric counting of potential events. So it enters earlier in his argument than one might realize. It's not explicit early on, but in saying that there are so many potential bad lives, that's based on already making that assumption.
But when we create people, we certainly create bad lives.
Some. They have potential bad experiences and potential good experiences. And we don't have an obligation to procreate, but that doesn't mean that the mere potential for pain in those lives is a reason to wipe them all out.
So I think what we would say from there is that why take the risk?
There's chance on both sides. And I think that there is some good in the existence of consciousness and civilization and science and philosophy, that these fields do advance.
Yeah.
And so,
and I would agree that when we're alive, when we exist, all of those things have tremendous value. I'm not disputing that at all. But what I would say is that they're coming at this incredibly high cost.
Well,
and I think that's where the extinctionist antinatalists are coming from.
Yes. Well, you can look at the actual cost, and it's pretty high. But I don't think it has to be that high. Remember, I saw happy families in Europe. Now, that doesn't mean that their lives have no suffering in them ever. But what that showed me is that social arrangements can affect how much happiness there tends to be in people's lives. And therefore, I don't think that the potential of sadness and pain, which will show up in most people's lives at some point, to some extent, necessarily means it would be better if a person hadn't been born. Now, there was a lot of pain in my life for some parts of it, and I used to wish I hadn't been born. And then when it was clear I had achieved something good for humanity, I had to rethink that. I mean, if I went only by my own happiness and my own pain, maybe it would still have been better if I hadn't been born. But when I looked at the good I had made for others, I started to think, no, maybe it's a good thing I was born, even though it meant I had to suffer.
Yeah, I think, so the way that I typically think about these things is that sort of like when we procreate, we're creating needs for no need. So like there's nothing in the universe that's like desperate for us, you know, and that when we create each other, we're sort of like almost spilling milk, you know, that we then have this job to clean up. And that's kind of a way of metaphoring the suffering. So it's like, you know, when once we're alive, we have all these issues, we have all these problems, we have all this need in the world, we have all these this suffering to fix. And
but it's not wonderful. Only suffering to fix. There is good also. There is good in thought. There is good in science. Yeah. There is good in philosophical thought too. Mm-hmm. And so I don't believe it's just creating need. It's also creating potential good. But how much good and how much suffering, that is to some extent a matter of what we decide.
Yeah.
And so I put attention into trying to lead to more good and less suffering.
Yeah, and that is extremely
And the
admirable.
Fact that in at least some areas of my life I've had good influence suggests to me that it's not futile.
I was curious if this is, you know, since publishing that article on your website, you know, is this a conversation that you've been asked about a lot with any regularity? I mean, the subject of having children. Is this something that, you know?
No, only once in a rare while.
Okay.
That's why, as I said, I was totally unaware that there was more, that there was activity and discussion on the topic of antinatalism. Except in the past couple of years, I was reading, for instance, in The Guardian about articles expressing, advocating antinatalism, rejecting and resisting natalist pressure. Of course, I've been aware of natalist pressure, but makes so many people's lives miserable. They just assume, well, of course we're going to have children. Of course we're going to be happy. We love each other, so we should have children. We'll be happy having children. But in the world as it is, we know that having children tends to ruin the love relationships of the parents. And by the time they're finished raising the children, they don't want to have anything to do with each other anymore. Of course, I'd seen that decades ago. And again, if a certain situation works out badly for lots of people, it's probably going to work out badly for me.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so glad you bring up natalist pressures and that was a part of your article, because I think that is one of the chief sort of reasons, you know, that I've noticed. I mean, the wonderful Finnish philosopher Matti Häyrä and I have recently co-authored a paper called The Imposition of a Lifestyle, where, you know, part of the argument that we're making there is that, you know, that is a real piece, that is a real part of the imposition of creating a new life, is this expectation that they're then going to become a natalist, that they're going to have all of these pressures on them from the time that they're a tiny little kid, really, in a myriad of ways. I mean, there's all kinds of different ways that we sort of inundate the young that follow them throughout their entire lives to then go on to, you know, keep having children. So I think natalist pressure is really an unspoken, often unspoken issue.
It's actually
incredible amount of anxiety and pressure people have on them.
It's much less in our society than in some others. I'm
sure,
in the middle of reading a book called What Muslims and Non-Muslims Get Wrong About Each Other by Sarfraz Manzoor, who is a Briton of Pakistani origin. And he's described, for instance, the pressure on him from his family. His mother was determined to his father first, but his father died, and then his mother still was determined to impose on him an arranged marriage, even though he had found a woman he wanted to marry. And that, of course, being married, which everybody was essentially compelled to do, was taken to imply also having children. Now, he wanted to have children, and his wife also. They weren't being compelled to do that, but part of his family punished him for marrying that non-Pakistani Briton. But the point is that the strength of the pressure in that society is shocking to us, because it's more pressure than our society actually puts on anyone. The natalist pressures in our society are subtler. I mean, they're you're reminded of them from time to time, of course, but if you've made up your mind, you can resist, and it's not so likely that your family will say, "We reject you if you won't have children. Get lost. Never talk to us again. We hate you."
Although there are certainly those horror stories, and I've definitely heard them, you know, where people lose their friend groups, you know, their parents never speak to them again, even within Western society.
Really?
So I would agree with you that in some cultures, it's far more prevalent and far worse. But I definitely do think that it's a piece of contemporary Western psychology as well.
Really? Well, maybe you could send me a link to a not too long article on that. I wouldn't want to read a whole book,
sure.
but I'm curious about that. I haven't come across that kind of intense pressure, explicit intense pressure.
Well, I'll definitely try to find something like that. I mean, I would say that maybe a lot of where I'm getting this from is rather anecdotal, especially people coming out, not just not wanting children, but coming out to their parents and friend groups as specifically as antinatalists. It's a little bit something extra to
maybe
come out
so.
As an antinatalist to your parents and friends group. But I'll
well,
I'll
I guess it might depend on which kind of antinatalist you are. For instance, are
exactly.
you an extinctionist? Or are you just, it's better not to have children in a world where things are going to hell?
Absolutely. And I mean, I think that both are rather taboo, but definitely there's being an extinctionist is a little bit more extreme, to say the least.
What I've been reading is that a large fraction of young people in the U.S., in Britain, and maybe Europe as well, are deciding not to have children because it's a bad idea.
Yeah.
And that's very wise. Now, it appears to me that having fewer or no children is an important contribution to trying to save the world from climate disaster, that the bigger we pump up the population now, the worse the disaster will be, and the less will survive it. So more species will be extinct, fewer will remain, more people will be killed, and fewer will survive. So if you have one more child, that means, of course, one more person is likely to die. That would be if the disaster were push things down to the same level. But if it's a worse disaster because the population grew, that means fewer will survive, which means that having one more child means more than one more death from climate disaster on the average.
Yeah, and the quality of those deaths will be
worse,
incredibly negative.
And the quality of the life of those who survive will be worse. And so it is a very powerful reason not to have children.
I agree. A sentiment in why it is important not to have children that I really love is when you say that because you didn't have children, you know, you were able to go on and create all these amazing things, you know, like the GNU project,
or the GNU operating system.
The operating system is what you might use.
The project is something you might participate in.
Correction noted. Thank you.
But also, it's the free software world, because free software is not limited to the GNU system alone. There's a lot of free software that isn't particularly part of the GNU system, but it's still a contribution to freedom for human beings.
Absolutely, absolutely. And all of this, I think, is something that, you know, a great deal of people miss, that enforcing somebody to have to live out, you know, their destiny, a new person to sort of live out their destiny, you may very well be giving up on your own. And that is a tragedy. I wish people would invest in their own lives rather than in an imposition.
Well, I don't, you know, I think that's too broad and misses the crucial part of the point.
Okay.
It's not just that not having children meant I could do whatever I would enjoy. I didn't respond to my life by being a hedonist. I had a mission. What I saw an evil that I was in a position to do something about. I was exactly the right person to do something about that evil, to correct part of it and replace it with good. And I dedicated myself to it, working very hard in a way that would have been impossible if I had had children. I couldn't have put my life, my efforts into correcting the injustice that I saw. And probably no one else would have, because few others became as dedicated to that as I, although many people joined in help once there was a movement they could join. There's no reason to think that there would have been a free software movement. There might have been some free software, but the idea that this was an important struggle, that we were replacing an unjust way of life that we should replace. In principle, we should try to replace it entirely. This is something I did because I wasn't saddled with something that was supposed to be a higher priority. Now, frankly, I'm not convinced that it's right to make raising a few children a higher priority than rescuing the world from a big injustice that affects more of a fraction of the world's population every year. But in any case, it may be hard to resist it. And it may induce terrible guilt to resist it, but I had nothing to be guilty about. I didn't have that other responsibility. I could make free software my responsibility.
Yeah.
And so
I know.
If you've got an idea for some good you can do, some contribution of whatever kind that'll go beyond just your own pleasure, well, having children is the biggest obstacle to doing that. Unless you're rich, in which case being rich may have corrupted you so that you don't care about other people so much anymore.
Very well said. And I did not in any way mean to insinuate that you chose this
for
some sort of hedonistic.
But the words you said, they included basically whatever the goal might be. So they included those whose other priorities that they would choose would be hedonistic, and those whose other priorities involved helping others, those that involved creating more possibilities to be free and not subjugated, whatever the whatever a person's, you know, you chose words that were independent of what someone's choice of priorities would be. And I think it does matter to some extent. Now, I'm not trying to say that you shouldn't ever do something just for your enjoyment. There's room for that. And until life turns into utter hell, which in 20 years it may, there's going to be room for that. And if we avoid horrible disaster, there'll still be always be room for that. It's a, I hope, but people shouldn't be, people shouldn't close their eyes to a duty to go beyond just having some enjoyment sometimes.
Well, as somebody that does believe it is always wrong to create lives, no matter what, I do think that if you do want to choose a hedonistic lifestyle as opposed to having a child, you are doing something more ethical than not. But yeah, if you to choose not to procreate for the sake of being able to develop something truly useful in the world as you've done, that's an even more noble choice to make. For sure. So if an antinatalist world, if it were to be possible in one form or another, is only one of a plethora of possible futures humanity could face. And there are many possibilities. For instance, some would rather see something akin to like a transhumanist future as opposed to an antinatalist future or a future in which all sentience has become extinct or humans have all become extinct. What chance do you think, or don't think, antinatalism has in its potential to influence people? What role do you think antinatalism should play in the future?
Well, there are these two different versions of antinatalism, of course. And so what I see is that an antinatalist practical philosophy, don't have children, the world is too... is too harsh, is influencing people. It has reduced birth rates. It may it may help avoid climate disaster. Doesn't guarantee we'll avoid climate disaster. It may we may destroy civilization anyway, which I think is a horrible thing. I don't think it will result in human extinction. Humans are awfully flexible. Humans with some not terribly scientific technology, but they had technology of their sort, survived all around the world in all sorts of difficult places and in often rather horrible circumstances. And I don't think that a climate disaster will result in the extinction of this species.
No.
But it will result in the, I think, in the end of science and of scientific technology. There won't be computers anymore, so the injustice of non-free software won't bother us, but the things we can do with technology, we won't be able to do anymore. We won't have modern medicine anymore. A few things might survive, like wash your hands and put alcohol on before you operate on someone. That'll still save some lives. But life will be a lot worse.
If that does end up being our future, like if we had a crystal ball right now, we saw that that's definitely going to be the case. Do you think that it would be better if humans went extinct before that happened?
There's no such crystal ball. It is not possible.
No, of course not.
So
of course not.
I'm not going to imagine that the world isn't chaotic. It's a chaotic system. There is no predicting. And
no, of course,
and of course, this prediction is far too complicated to imagine we could predict it. So I'd rather focus on the existence of still ways to prevent climate disaster. Of course, we're going to have to defeat the planet roasters. It's not just accident and lack of thinking that is dragging us toward climate disaster. It is the intentional activity of greedy bastards who are willing to make billions of people suffer and very likely die.
Yeah. I know that you would certainly disagree with this, but just as a you know, I want to say that I think that extinctionist antinatalists would say that even at the best of times, there is so much existence of suffering on planet Earth, be it in the forms of human suffering and animal suffering, that it would always be best not to create those lives. Do you have any sort of closing?
I don't agree. To wipe out all animal life would be an enormous crime. And there's still nothing to stop it from evolving again. It probably would.
Do you think life will find a way?
I think it would, yes. I mean, we've seen mass extinctions, and they're followed by evolution of new animals and new plants, some of which are different from all the ones that existed before.
Yeah. I would consider myself a reverse biocentric antinatalist. So even though I have absolutely no agency in any of this, certainly, I think it would be better, given the magnitude of suffering possible, that, you know, evolution be stopped, the existence of life be stopped, because I can't see any reason, I can't see any good that comes from the existence of suffering. I think it comes at far too high a price, no matter what else is possible or what other joys can be produced.
I'm not convinced that that's true even for humans today.
Yeah. And I respect that completely. I really want to thank you so much, Richard, for coming on the show and giving me your perspective. It really is truly valuable. And it's been an absolute honor and pleasure speaking with you today. I want to ask you, is there anything that you're working on now that you'd like to tell us a little bit about? Where can people find you on the internet, and how can our audience best support your work?
I'm not working on technical projects anymore. I'm trying to keep the free software movement going and cope with disasters such as Snoop phones, which are designed so that you can't replace their software with free software. And they're designed to run probably it's millions of different non-free apps, each of which is released by a different organization. There's no hope of replacing them all. And they're all unjust because they're all non-free software. And almost all of them are designed to do explicitly to do nasty things. In other words, they have malicious functionalities. If you look at GNU.org/malware, you'll find out about the prevalence of malicious functionalities in non-free software. It's not only that it denies your freedom, but having done that, it takes advantage of subjugating you to mistreat you in specific ways that are designed into it, and there's very little that limits how far that can go. The main way we can limit that is to reject non-free software. When some organization says, install our convenient app, I say, don't give me that crap.
That's a great tagline. I love that.
The place to find me is mainly stallman.org. I post some political notes basically every day and occasionally a new article. And there's also, of course, GNU.org for the free software movement and the GNU operating system. And there's also FSF, that's initials of freesoftwarefoundation.org, which describes the Free Software Foundation. And I urge you to please join the Free Software Foundation. It promotes and defends free software, and it needs your support. In particular, it needs your financial support. So please give your help. You can also volunteer to do work. And it's not limited to writing software. There are many kinds of volunteer work you can do. If you look at gnu.org/help, there are dozens of different kinds of work that we could use.
Absolutely brilliant. Well, all of those links will be below. I definitely invite everybody to go peruse them and help support all of your fine works. Just once again, thank you so much for being my guest today on the Exploring Antinatalism podcast, Richard. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Happy hacking.
Thank you for listening to the Exploring Antinatalism podcast. Please follow the podcast on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Exploring Antinatalism can also be heard on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Buzzsprout, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Amazon.com, and so many other platforms. You can email me at exploringantinatalism@gmail.com. Website designed by Visions Noirs. Please follow him at www.bilenoir.com and follow him on Instagram. Logo art by Life Sucks. Please subscribe to him on YouTube and check out his shop on Etsy at www.etsy.com/shop/lifesuckspublishing. Music by Mati Hairi. You can hear the whole song, Life is a Sexually Transmitted Disease with a Mortality Rate of 100%, by following the link in the description. And make sure to also read his academic paper, which inspired the song, If You Must Give Them a Gift, Then Give Them the Gift of Non-Existence, in the Cambridge Quarterly of Healthcare Ethics on cambridge.org. Links below. All the best, and bye for now.
Life is no thrill compared to Neil. Life is no thrill, it's worse than Neil. So draw the right conclusion, let them be still.